Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. I've been really looking forward to this week's episode. We're speaking with Falk Blail. He is CTO at Utopi. And just heads up, this might feel a bit like an advertorial at points, but it's not. I mean, normally, even if we're talking about a product or a specific thing that someone's made, we'll at least try and couch the conversation within a broader context. But in this episode, we barely bothered. We're speaking with Falk about it's a sensor-based data platform. They describe it as an ESG platform. The thing is, that really underplays the true value of what the product offers. As you'll hear, it addresses things we talk about nearly every week, so it felt like that was enough. What Utopi is it's a glorified, in a positive sense, POE, a post-occupancy evaluation monitoring platform. They install sensors in a building, collect, manage, and interpret the data, and advise their clients on how to respond to what they learn. Like, it's amazing. As it turns out, this is a service that is just as relevant to the most red in tooth and claw capitalist landlord as it is an aspirant socialist housing provider. Monitoring and maintenance, and by implication retrofit, are, through the platform, being proven to positively affect the value of the building asset itself. Now, the reason why I've been excited about it is because this feels massively important for a world where public sector is continually instructed to copy the private sector and indulge governments in their desire for market-based decision-making at every turn, whether it's more efficient in reality or not. So these guys, with their platform, have managed to prove that efficiency pays. That monitoring shows you where to invest your time, reduce operational costs, reduce carbon emissions. Like, they can build a positive case for all the things that seem so hard to do. Anyway, right, it's brilliant. We're telling everyone about it. Now we're telling you as well. Jeff and I met with Falk last week. Just a few last things in the conversation. We talk about IoT, that's the Internet of Things. We refer to TRV, that's thermostatic radiator valve, you know, like the temperature control on a radiator. We talk about wet central heating, that's hydronic heating, so radiators with water in them. And for anyone who doesn't know what ESG means, we mention it quite frequently, but just in case, that's a framework for assessing the performance of a business in non-financial terms. So environment, social, governance. So environmental impact, social impact, and the impact of their governance processes, like not being corrupt in that. Right, that's it. Hope you enjoy it. And thank you for listening. Oh, right. And apologies. My voice is wrecked. I went to an agency party. Like, someone launched a research report the other night, and it was in a loud room with lots of people and lots of drink. And I think most people there spend the whole evening shouting at one another. My voice has been wrecked for 2 days. So, yeah, apologies to the listeners too. Unless you like this husky version. how you doing, man?
Good, yeah, good, thank you. It's been an interesting week again, and just looking forward to having our discussion today and see where that takes us.
All right, I just need to nip off. I need to get some loo roll. My nose is, I have a lingering cold. I'll just be 1 second.
All right.
So, Falk, you said an interesting week. Are you at liberty to divulge why?
We're in the process of doing some proof of concept testing to control panel heaters. And one of the things with current smart panel heaters that are out there, certainly the types that use consumer type technology, are not particularly suited to our target customer base. So we operate in the managed residential space, so large residential buildings, whether it's built to rent or purpose-built student accommodation, for example. And in that case, the operator would like to have some co-management, at least, with the residents. And
is this in common areas or in actual
living areas? It is in actual living areas. Especially in student accommodation, you know, because in that case, it is the operator that pays the bills, you know, so they have a vested interest in that. And also, you know, through some of the work that we have done and some data that we've gathered, and also anecdotally, operators know that at least some students excessively heat their rooms over long periods of times, you know, and when it's the operator that pays the bills, we have seen electricity consumption in single studios over the course of a year in excess of 9,000 kilowatt hours. That is in a single studio.
That's quite some doing. Yeah.
It's an achievement, you know. So from that point of view, there are good reasons as to why operators in those kinds of environments want to have, you know, a certain degree of control. Doesn't mean that the heating needs to be switched off all the time or anything like that. There are other mechanisms, you know, that are currently deployed, like boost buttons and timers and things like that. You know, but we see a lot of things that happen where some degree of active control is actually valid. You know, students leaving over the holidays, for example, or leaving at the weekends and not turning the heating down and so on. You know, there's no benefit in heating a room then. There's just a cost associated with it. And when I say cost, you know, there's a carbon cost as well as, you know, a financial cost.
How do you know they've left the room for the weekend?
So,
well, do you want to use, sorry, Falk, do you want to use this as an opportunity to explain what Utopi does, because that who you are, why we are so delighted to talk to you, because like I've been telling everyone about you wherever it's appropriate. I think it's brilliant what you've been learning. It's fascinating. So yeah, right, floor's yours.
Okay, thank you. So Utopi is a company that provides what we call an ESG platform, in the sense of actually doing a couple of things that are important both to the investor, the operator, and also the resident in the types of properties that we get involved in. And they are, like I said, multi-family residences or multi-tenant residences. Purpose-built student accommodation is probably the biggest market for us at the moment, because there's the biggest need in that respect. But we also have a large estate of built-to-rent properties. We have approaching 50,000 residential units under contract, and we have deployments across 8 European countries. And when I say European countries, I include the UK in that, at least geographically, if maybe not politically, but economically, clockwise anymore.
Sentimentally, I think is the most appropriate. Yeah.
And what we do is we provide our clients with the ability to actually gather what I always refer to as real-time, contextual, and granular data. So where possible, what we do is we gather data from within individual residences, and we do that on a real-time basis so that we get, you know, utility consumption data, depending on the client. That may only be electricity. In some cases, it is electricity and heat and water. Sometimes it's even a difference between hot and cold water as well. You know, to gather this information on a per unit basis, whatever that unit may be. And then the other thing that we do is we deploy IoT sensors that look like this, like the multi-sensor that we actually manufacture directly ourselves. And that device provides context. So it gathers information on temperature, humidity, air quality, and noise, light, and motion. And with that, you know, you were asking earlier, why or how do you know if somebody's in or isn't in? Our sensor tells us that. And we therefore have time series data on a per residential unit basis, you know, for all those particular metrics and utility consumption. And that gives us the opportunity to really look at, you know, some of the things that are happening, and to actually see and understand behaviors and also influence behaviors. You know, and we've done some very interesting work, especially in the student space, also to try and influence behaviors. But we've also done it in built-to-rent. Now, in built-to-rent, residents pay their own bills. But, you know, we have with one of our partners and clients run a campaign, you know, like if you're going on holiday or if you're going away over Christmas, you know, consciously switch off the heating or turn the heating down while you're away, you know, in order to save not just money in your pocket, but also help save the environment. And like I said, within student, we've run campaigns also to bring down, you know, excessive heating, you know, by targeting students directly. And that can be both generally speaking and also in some cases looking at the extreme outliers, you know, to actually go and have a look and see what's going on within a particular space and maybe speak to a student. And we've seen things like, and it's not all sinister what happens. In fact, in most cases, it isn't, you know, it is perhaps a student that's never considered, you know, turning down the heating, or they just like it warm, or they don't know how to turn down the heating and so on. And it may sound crazy, but it's sometimes literally those kinds of, you know, very little interventions that can have a big and positive impact on, again, utility consumption and with that emissions as well.
I really like, I mean, the reason why we got so excited about this, Alex and I in particular, was you're delivering, you're using data and sensors. So when you said IoT, that's Internet of Things, for anyone who didn't pick that up or hasn't heard it before, you're using all this data to improve someone's experience of living in a place. Like, it's what you do, you're not just gathering data, you're helping people to, like, literally the way you described it is you're actually helping people to live better, potentially make it more comfortable, more affordable, like optimizing. So it's like a CX, customer experience exercise, not just how do we reduce costs.
No, that's right. It is both, you know, and really the data set that we have, we use for investors, you know, because with that, they can see what's going on and they can see hopefully a trend, you know, a downward trend in consumption. We help operators because we give them visibility where they didn't have any before. And, you know, consumption, utility consumption, and especially heating and overheating is something, it changes in student accommodation from year to year and from student to student. So, you know, you try and you educate once. Next year, you have a new cohort of residents in your building, you know, and you have to do the same thing again, effectively. You know, so it's an ongoing process that needs to be followed. And for the resident, you know, that lives within a space like that, being able to see that where I am having an impact or making choices actually has a positive impact on, you know, the level of carbon emissions for the building, or has a positive impact on what I do in terms of my impact and footprint on the globe, so to speak. You know, that's being done as well. Quite often in a student environment, we see that there are other incentives that need to come into play as well. You know, so we've started the process of gamifying some of these things, and you know that's making a marked difference, you know, in actually bringing those, especially those excessive outliers, you know, down, so that the overall temperature within a building, which we can determine because we have this data literally from every room within the building, we calculate things like averages across the building, and with that you then have a macro view on micro decisions, if you like, that are made in every single space. And with that, you can see who's contributing either positively or negatively to that, and then you can help that process, you know, to actually, you know, reach a certain target temperature. When we spoke previously, I think I mentioned in Germany with the Ukraine war, what happened, Germany being heavily reliant on Russian gas, the government actually mandated that in public buildings must not be heated beyond 19 degrees centigrade. And they just said, you know, that's it. That is what needs to happen. And that had a massive impact on gas consumption in Germany. And while we're not saying that 19 degrees for residential spaces is the maximum temperature, what we're saying is that whatever an operator wants to set as their comfortable target temperature, or so that's what they can tailor their campaigns towards, if you like, you know, and encourage residents, you know, to act consciously to get there.
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask, Falk, what kind of concerns do you get from residents, and how do you address them? You know, I know there's a certain strand of people out there who believe they're being ruled by a secret race of shape-shifting space lizards. You know, you get all sorts of strange views out there from people about being controlled. You know, some folk, a lot of the time men, in fact. So, how do you ensure that different kinds of residents, or how do you deal with different kinds of residents who may have different views on not having total control of certain aspects of their life?
Well, the thing is, there is control, but you know, in some cases, what we do is we look at control, you know, within certain boundaries. So, for example, that you have a TRV, you know, where you can't turn the temperature up beyond, let's say, 25 degrees or something like that. And that, you know, if somebody steps out the room, leaves the room for, you know, several hours or so, that at some point we step down the temperature and say, right, okay, nobody's been in for X number of hours. We turn the temperature back down to a more reasonable level as such. And when somebody comes back in again, they can turn it back up again, you know, within the bands that somebody has set, you know, and what those bands are is something that the operator determines, and they may also set some exceptions. So if there's somebody who constantly complains, oh, I'm cold, and you know, I'm sure we've all lived with people, or we know people that like, you know, maybe higher temperatures, and some may like lower temperatures, and so on, you know,
some people need a different temperature. My mom, for instance, exactly. She's disabled, and mm-hmm. like she feels the cold much differently to yes. I mean, anyone else I know.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's really interesting what you're saying there, because I'll give another example in a minute, you know, as to how to address some of those things. But on our platform, what we can do is we can accommodate exceptions, you know, so that if somebody needs a higher temperature set, then that can be done on a room by room basis, effectively, you know, by way of a default or as a standard, you know, there should be certain measures. I mean, if I could have done that at home when our children were younger, I would have been delighted as such, you know. Because otherwise, it's been my job maybe to turn down the temperature in rooms on occasion.
You're going to try and stop the tyranny of the father going around micromanaging everyone and shutting yeah. doors and castigating their children over all the things they're doing wrong.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah, just say, well, your heating system doesn't put out any more than what you're getting at the moment. No, maybe not quite. But the other example I was going to mention, you know, when you talked about having people who need higher temperatures, we also have deployed our solution in care homes. And basically, in care homes, you have a situation. Quite often, they're wet central heated systems, and they also have covers over the radiators that often cover the radiator valves also. So what you have there typically is you have radiators that are turned up full, and then the way that temperature is regulated is by opening and closing windows. Okay. And literally, that's it, you know, because, you know, there is no easy way of getting at an individual radiator and, you know, changing that, because you would have to remove the cover or do something in order to get to it. So what we've done in those examples is we've actually deployed smart TRVs that sit behind the cover. Now, they register a far higher temperature, as you can imagine, because they sit, you know, effectively inside a box. But we use our multi-sensor to effectively tell the TRV what temperature it really is, and we then regulate the temperature in rooms to the target temperature that they would wish. So with that, you know, okay, from a ventilation point of view, air quality point of view, obviously you still want to, you know, be able to open windows and so on. We're not restricting that whatsoever, but using the windows to regulate temperature is no longer
needed. It's a really interesting one, Volk, this because there was a project many years ago in Ireland doing the rounds, Stewart's Hospital in Palmerstown, and it was a private hospital, and it won some energy awards. And there was a period of time where it was being presented all the time at conferences and stuff. And it was a sort of similar scenario to what you described. It was Dalkia who did it, you know, they're part of the Veolia group, big kind of company who specialize in district heating solutions and so on. They do ESCO, the energy service company kind of work, where they fund the works themselves and deliver savings for people. But in this case, what they did was they put in a new efficient setup of boiler at a combined heat and power plant, and they put in heating controls, right, to stop the rooms getting as hot. But the concern I have is precisely what you reference. If you're in like a hospital ward, you know, or a room that's got a number of occupants in it, what you find is because of the lack of ventilation systems in most buildings, most residential buildings, the only thing that drives ventilation is that discomfort. In other words, people feel too hot in the deeper plan areas of the rooms. So they demand that the windows are opened. And then, of course, the people who are next to the windows feel the cold. So they, and you get this kind of unhelpful kind of tension between people in that way too. But at least because it was getting too hot, you were getting some simplistic and weather-dependent ventilation. So it's how you balance that against the need to stop air quality from declining, because people tend to be very bad judges of indoor air quality. And we're dealing with vulnerable people here too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've thought about?
Well, our devices also measure air quality. So from that point of view, it is possible, you know, to look at both of those things, you know, and actively consider them.
And to send signals to the operators or to the, you know, to the residents,
it's possible to set up alerts, you know, if that's what's wanted, and it's possible, you know, to look at that longitudinally as well, you know, in order to see what is happening and how is it happening, you know, and is trickle ventilation on windows, you know, is that sufficient or not, or do you ventilate the rooms consciously?
God, that's great. Yeah, I mean, you have potential to do so much good there, because, of course, one of the, you know, the points that I kind of referenced there with trickle ventilation, for instance, or other background ventilation, is that even if the vents are open or even if windows are open, there'll be some conditions where you won't get the air changes that you need.
Yeah.
Still summer days, for instance, right? So you have the potential to expose the deficiencies in a ventilation strategy with this, you know, you know, because the hypothesis I was opening with, it's a very crude solution to a problem anyway, you know, this allowing a room to get too hot and therefore, you know, kind of compelling people to open windows to kind of to feel comfort. The thing with air quality, it's so kind of context specific as well, and understanding, looking at the data you're getting in an intelligent way to understand what the problem is, and you know, is it a problem if CO2 levels, for instance, are getting high for a period of time or whatever. But just having the tools to enable people to understand whether the strategies they're deploying in a building are working or not, that's power. That is proper power. Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting what you're saying, because we see exactly those kinds of questions being asked. And the data that comes, because we have this incredibly rich and detailed data set for a building, it's actually beginning to get our clients to consider potential design changes. Like many of our clients, what they do is they buy and sell assets quite regularly. And, you know, from that point of view, if an asset is bought that has no data, no historic data, we can go in, we can retrofit our solution, you know, within a couple of days, really. You know, if there's a 500 apartment building, it may take us 2 or 3 days to install a complete solution, you know, across that building. You know,
What kind of crews do you have that you're able to do? I mean, how quick is it to install, and how are you able to deploy them that quickly?
So brilliant, isn't it?
If you're just looking at our sensor, you know, which we've purposely designed for this particular space, it takes somebody probably less than 5 minutes for sure to install one of these, you know, in a plasterboard ceiling. So effectively, what you do is you drill a hole, you put the recess cup in. And you stick a battery, you know, into the sensor. You scan the QR code on an installation app that we have, and you pop it into the ceiling, and that's it. You're done. And literally within a couple of minutes, you'll be able to see data. And we've had customers who said, "Oh yeah, you'll probably need to gather data for a couple of months before you get anything sensible and anything valuable out of it." And there was one client who had exactly that comment. And I showed them the heat map that we have, which gives you a single screen view of your whole building, with hundreds of apartments on it, or hundreds of rooms on it. And while I was talking to him, that heat map came up, and he interrupted me and says, "Why is that one at 27 degrees? Oh, there's one at 28. You know, what's going on here?" And so on, you know. And that was literally within seconds of him seeing the heat map for the first time. And that sold the idea to him that effectively, by having by having this holistic view, and like I said, not everybody's going to look at a heat map. We can set alerts and send reports and all that good stuff as well. But visually, you know, it was very easy and very quick for somebody to look at that and say, I can see my outliers right there, right then. You know, and instead of, having to look at the whole building and seeing where the problems are, you know, you can see that on the platform. You know, so every metric that comes out of the multi-sensor, you can see on the heat map, you know, as a separate view, if you like. You know, it's like looking down on Earth with a satellite, and you take different spectrum, you know, images as such. And it's almost like that, what we can do with a building. And then what you can do is when you see outliers, you can have a look at the history of that and see, well, is this a single incident, or is this something that's been there for longer? And we've found things like misconfigured electric panel heaters, air conditioning systems that weren't set up properly. We found people plugging in their own plug-in heaters, which are a health and safety risk, a fire risk, in a multifamily setting. And all sorts of things, through this. And, having that capability really helps the operators to address situations, if you like, that they come across.
One of the things I found particularly interesting about your positioning is that you're looking specifically at the private sector rather than social housing environments and similar, yeah, which are often a training ground for a technology like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like there, you've mentioned investors.
Yes. Right?
They were the first people you mentioned, I think, as being part of your user set. I think that's really interesting because it is often the case that we are looking for people with capital to deploy, to make changes throughout this the built environment.
Yes.
And what your platform offers is for people who are trying to make money, to do better by everyone involved.
Yes.
So like in terms of climate, reducing operational emissions by getting them, illustrating, showing them how to think strategically about managing their assets to reduce their costs, through which we improve environmental outcomes.
Yes.
Specifically in terms of emissions. I think it's brilliant.
The beauty in our market, and in our solution is that environmental and economic goals are aligned. Okay. There are many other scenarios where that's not the case. Okay. But in this case, it is absolutely and squarely aligned, because an operator pays less, for utilities because, they can spot waste easily and address that. And from an environmental point of view, the greenest kilowatt hour of electricity that you use, that is there, is the one that you don't use. And so from that point of view, it is in everybody's interest, really, to be studious, really, in the way that we use the resources, that we have. And, in some cases that we generate as well.
Yeah.
And really for us, we are at a point now, we have referenceability and we have a proven business case that actually shows an investor, and this is completely different from social housing. I understand that, I accept that. I have spent a large part of my career selling to the public sector. So I understand that the motivations and drivers there are fundamentally different from the private sector. In the private sector, you always need to have an economic outcome that is positive. You know, over a period of time, doesn't need to be instant, can be over, a couple of years or so. But the private sector won't do something if there isn't, an economic benefit. But we are now at a point where with our clients, we have externally validated proof that our solution actually adds value to the buildings that they own. And because those buildings are traded, there's a direct and immediate return on investment, not necessarily immediate, in the reduction, because, clearly that's something that will show over a period of time. But there is a real and immediate return on investment in asset value as a result of somebody deploying our technology within their buildings, and we have external validation of that.
That's the most amazing bit. That's the bit I'm telling everyone about. Like, this dude has this platform, and he's demonstrated on a macro level that if you manage your operational consumption, you can, if you manage your building better, you can reduce your operational consumption and increase your occupancy, and you can draw a direct link between your, I think, 2 billion data points and the value of the asset. Because the way real estate investors work, which not everyone may know, is they acquire a big lump of money from a bunch of different investors. They put it into a fund. They buy an asset, so like a building that they can turn into rental accommodation or an office block or something, whatever, it doesn't really matter. And they improve the building, increase occupancy, reduce costs, and then knock it out after 3 years or whatever the investment horizon is. And that's their model, so that you can demonstrate to them, like, here, lads, retrofit works in a way that we interviewed John Bagley from Countrywide Surveying Services, or then of, I think he's at UK Finance now, who, head of risk and technical, we asked him belligerently, repeatedly, can you demonstrate a link between retrofit and an increased value of a domestic housing asset? And repeatedly, he said no. But in a nice way, he wasn't. He was. We were belligerent. He wasn't.
Yeah.
You can't do it at a micro level, but on a macro level, oh boy.
this is the question, Fox. So how do you do it? How can you explain to us what witchcraft you're using? How you said externally validated as well. How does this happen?
So how does this happen? So we have shown that by using our technology, we are driving down utility consumption, you know, by a certain percentage, okay? And conservatively, that's 15%, okay? And for an operator of one of those asset types that we have, the value of a building is directly linked to net operating income. Okay, so the value of a building is not determined by the value of the bricks and mortar as such that is there, but how much income a particular asset can generate. Okay, that's why the same building physically that you have in the center of London, and you know on the outskirts of, you know, a less attractive city, if you like, same building, same build costs and everything else, the same building in London will be far more valuable because, you know, you can command higher rents, and you know, therefore then the operating income will be greater. That is what's driving actual, you know, asset value in that respect. Okay.
So you're seeing the actual rental prices are being reflected by the performance. I thought you were going to be saying that it's like student housing specific, where the operating costs for the owner include the energy costs, you know. Yes.
So net operating income, you know, for an operator of a building like this is effectively the difference between you know, the income that they bring in and the costs that go out. And utility costs are a significant proportion of the costs that go out for that building. So, you know, if you can increase rents, fantastic. That's wonderful. We have no direct influence on that as such. But when it comes to decreasing the costs, especially where the operator pays the bills, you know, that at that point, effectively, that has a direct impact on net operating income. And therefore, that then in turn has a direct impact on the asset value. There are a couple of other things also, you know, so we contribute to certifications, asset level certifications. I don't know if you're aware of GRESB. Yes. Okay. So GRESB is used, you know, to indicate how well a building is performing and so on. And we directly contribute to some of the points, if you like, that are available under that. And it's the same also under BREEAM in use, where we also can contribute. And some of our customers are also interested in Fitwel. And while our sensor that we deploy in every room is not Fitwel accredited, that's a different conversation. We also have other sensors that actually, you know, gather data that can help towards those accreditations. So effectively what we can do is we can help. And again, you know, we're not saying that we are the only determinant in this, but we can help, you know, effectively raise the level of attainment, you know, both on GRESB, pre-ambiguous unfit wear. And that has a direct impact on the attractiveness of an asset, when it comes to the trading of an asset.
This is fascinating. On the ESG sense more broadly, because you're operating in different countries too, because you're deploying systems in different countries.
Yes.
Are you noticing differences in the drivers, the ESG-related drivers from different European countries? In other words, you know, we have things like the EU taxonomy, the sustainable financial disclosure regulations, the CSRD, and so on. The hope that I have, in spite of Brexit, is that the financial markets are so international that the Brexit isn't really affecting things too much. But are you seeing what are you seeing out there?
So many of our clients have assets internationally. So from that point of view, one of the reasons why we internationalize so quickly, and probably 50% of the assets that we have under contract are in international, so outside of the UK, and the remaining 50% are within. And for a relatively young company as we are, internationalizing so quickly, is perhaps unusual. And one of the reasons for that is because our clients are international. They have European operations, they have European and US operations, and we're doing some work over in the US as well, to test the market there. But to come back to your question about the EU taxonomy, the SFDR funds that are, put together, and you talked about investment funds. Most investment funds today are SFDR Article 6 funds, and there is an ambition and a recognition that really what funds want to be is they want to be Article 8 funds, because they have these greater and more stringent credentials. And what we do by deploying our technology and working with our clients is we help them on that journey. And again, I understand that we are a small cog in a big wheel that way, but we're contributing positively to their ambition to take assets. The funds are portfolio wide, not asset wide. So an individual asset, if an individual asset can become an asset that is, eligible, if you like, to be in an Article 8 fund, that's really what everybody wants. They want to be able to have assets that contribute, to that lifting, if you like, of standards in that respect.
And to be clear to our listeners, Article 8 is defined, as I recall, under the SFDR as light green funds. Article 9 is meant to be dark green, and there was a controversy last year over a bunch of funds losing their Article 9 status, I think, because they weren't found to be actually green enough. But that's powerful. And if you're seeing that it's happening at portfolio level rather than asset level, then that kind of means that everything needs to be to a certain level to ensure that you fall into that category, right?
Yes. And really the whole thing is when it comes to the trading of assets, and to be honest, before we set out on this venture, I did not appreciate the fact that assets, individual buildings, were traded so regularly. But basically, if you want to trade an asset, if you want to sell an asset at some point, if you sell an asset that effectively would not qualify to become part of an Article 8 fund, you have fewer potential takers for that. And again, that affects the market price of an asset. So, what we're doing is we're helping. Again, I understand in a small way, but we're helping in a way that moves the needle, to help people change an Article 6 fund-based asset to one that is eligible, to actually become an Article 8 type asset.
You say it's small, but if you can help people to reduce operational energy, there's loads of different indicators you have to look at when you get into ESG. But operational energy, in particular, if people are using a fossil energy source, it's disproportionate in its significance, compared to most of the other indicators. One of the concerns I have, it's important that we address sustainability in buildings in the round, and not even just in terms of carbon. There's a bunch of other things to think about. But there is a danger if we get into too many different metrics that we you end up just confounding people and losing sight of the ones that are really important. I think, in other words, if you're helping to achieve 10-15% reductions in overall delivered energy costs, and that's including, presumably, you're talking, when you talk about that, I presume are you talking about just the regulated loads or the total, in other words, including plug loads, the total energy use in the building?
Oh, it's total loads.
That's really significant. So don't downplay yourself, Paul.
Yeah, okay.
You're too modest.
We work on the premise that we under promise and over deliver. that's the approach that we like to take, because we hate disappointing customers, you know. And so from that point of view, you know, like the 15%, that's a figure that's been underwritten externally as such. We see some that have, you know, achieved more than that. Absolutely.
That's amazing. So if I might take us into a slightly different space, tangentially related to where Jeff was taking us.
Yeah.
So this endeavor, because you're working with the private sector, with investors.
Yes.
They're all about putting their capital to work, which means they're up for spending money. Like, they have to spend money. They spend it on the asset. They have to improve the asset. They have to justify their intervention towards increasing the asset's value to enable it to be traded. And this means working with you enables them to develop a strategy for improving the building and improving the management of the building, which is post-occupancy evaluation mixed with maintenance. So all of a sudden, you have capital expenditure, CapEx, being mixed with operational expenditure, OPEX. And those two fuckers, they're normally like oil and water. They cannot mix. Worse than that, they usually can't perceive one another. They are like spooky action at a distance, then particles that they are linked. But one affects the other, but they're so far apart as to, well, presumably not be able to perceive one another. Like, I don't know what sort of a question I've got. How are you making that work? Like, how open are people to thinking proactively about the building? Or are you using the data and the illustrations you can derive from the data to influence their thinking?
Okay. It's a very good question. If we're not talking about retrofit, but let's say we're talking about somebody who carefully designs and plans their building. In the first instance, okay? What we see is that things like the Part L regulations, for example, they're carefully written. And if you read them as a lawyer, basically when it comes to submetering, you know, and it says, oh yeah, you know, meters or submeters are required for 90% of consumption. You know, that's the first thing. You know, so you can tick that box by putting the submeters in. But there's one thing where it talks about you know, submeters should be capable of being you know, remotely and automatically read. Okay, now as a lawyer, as soon as you read the word "should," what do you do? You say, oh, that's nice. Okay. So it should be able to do that. So I put a meter in there that sits somewhere in a riser, you know, that has a pulse output. Now, what earthly use, you know, once that building is handed over, does a meter that has a pulse output that sits somewhere, you know, in a riser, you know, halfway up a building or in some corner, what earthly use does that pulse output have for somebody who operates that building once that building is in operation? None whatsoever. Because nobody will ever go and put a device on there, because again, that costs money, okay? And the regulations just say that the meter needs to be capable of being read remotely, not that it shall be done. It just needs to have that capability. So who at that point is going to take that meter, put a pulse reader on it, and then connect that pulse reader, you know, to some output mechanism or some data logger or something like that? It's just not going to happen. We see the same thing, you know, on distribution boards where meters quite often have Modbus outputs that are not connected to anything. Or if they are connected to something, it's typically the BMS. The BMS is just a black hole for data. Nobody knows how to deal with that and how to look at it and so on. So what we're doing, or what we're trying to do, is to help as part of the building design and specification to say, look, if you put meters in, as you should, put this type of meter in because and we use I haven't mentioned it here yet, but we use LoRaWAN as a wireless technology. And LoRaWAN is really interesting inside buildings because it reaches much further than Wi-Fi does. So you need fewer gateways. And rather than using wireless MBUS, which is another metering communications protocol, which is a one-trick pony, what we're doing is we're deploying LoRaWAN as a strategic wireless platform that gathers data and delivers control in some cases, across a variety of different technologies. It's not just for metering. Our multi-sensor works on the same basis, and there are other devices that we deploy that use the same wireless protocol. So you put one strategic non-Wi-Fi wireless infrastructure in place. And with that, if you want to have a water meter somewhere in the building, you can put a water meter in that uses the same technology. You don't need any data cabling. And the data just comes into the platform and you can display it. And, you were asking how we do retrofit. It's like that. It's effectively saying, right, okay, in some cases we rip and replace meters. In other cases, what we do is, if there's an existing data cabling infrastructure and data loggers and so on, we get the data out of them. And in some cases, we actually add that capability to it as well. But the whole idea is if you design a building, in such a way that the meter is already there, that it's already capable of doing it, and that you're not adding complications by saying, oh, we now need Belden cables, strung all the way across the buildings and data loggers here and there and so on. If you plan it strategically at the beginning, you get the benefits.
And LoRaWAN is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's meant to be kind of more robust than Wi-Fi in terms of not getting, one thing we see when we look at logged data on temperature and air quality often, but from sensors is gaps in the data for periods of time. LoRaWAN is less prone to that. Is that not right?
It's less prone to that. It does miss, like any wireless communication that works. There's a potential of missing transmissions so on. And we take the approach that since we're measuring hourly typically, that if you miss a transmission here and there, it doesn't really matter.
Doesn't matter too much. But I have to say, I'm really, really interested in that. Sorry for letting you off, but you can potentially answer, depending on what kinds of versions of your systems are going in, depending on what you're measuring, you can potentially tell an awful lot about how successful or problematic a building has been, or a particular strategy. So for instance, one of the ones now you talked about rises and so on. One of the issues now that's a big issue in apartment buildings in Dublin and in London, and obviously more besides, but it's just that there's a lot of these are similar kinds of climates and areas where you're getting more apartment buildings. We've got low energy apartment buildings that are having communal heating systems, mm-hmm. And overheating problems. Mm-hmm. And there's even a high profile case in the newspaper that Ireland at the moment with I think the most expensive apartment development in the country. Rod Stewart is one of the owners.
All right. Okay.
A place called Lansdowne Place, and the residents are suing the developer. So you presumably will be able to gather enormously useful data on. Well, I don't know. Is that something you're looking at specifically? And are you looking at getting data on the building and the specifications for the building and cross referencing that against the outputs you're getting?
Yes. So the answer is absolutely yes. And we have done a study on something very similar to what you've mentioned just there for a client, to actually look at. I need to be careful how I phrase this. Look at predicted building performance, and there are now overheating risk assessments that are done prior to a building being built, that consider climate change and all those kinds of things, and how that stacked up that predictive
Interesting.
Report, yeah. How that stacked up against actual performance. And that can be scary. It can be really scary.
We know that there's that old maxim with models, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out. And we know that we've seen very credible sort of overheating and temperature assessment tools. We've seen real data on real buildings where the actual recorded temperatures are a million miles away from what the simulation is predicting.
Yeah. And why is that? I can tell you why. Because when you have a building and the simulation is based on a window being open 24/7, you know, it's laughable.
Yeah.
If that is what drives the overheating risk assessment, where you say, right, okay, every window in this building is open 24/7 when it's hot outside, you know, and then heat doesn't accumulate within the building, that's just totally unrealistic. You know, and if that's the premise on which you do your assessment in order to get your pass, then that's wrong. I mean, obviously, there are a whole host of other things, you know, that you can look at when it comes to K and G values of glass and, you know, what you spec into a building and so on. You know, those things can and need to be considered. But buildings in the UK are built to keep heat in, not to let heat out. Mm.
Well, they're supposed to be. I mean, they're not very good at building to keep heat in a lot of time as well. But I think one of the tools in particular, I know an academic who reckons that it really struggles with shading, can't handle shading properly, and recognize the significance of it. You know,
this is why, like, I have been so enthused, because again, what you're describing there is an intrinsic, ongoing, open-ended POE system. Doing post-occupancy evaluation, driven by money, so people are going to pay attention. Like, indirectly, you are improving the experience for human beings who exist within those apartments, because no one wants overheating and no one wants underheating, because this is being done to protect the building asset.
Yeah.
And because you're monitoring against expectations... So expectations create your first set of benchmarks. You're monitoring, as you just described, like appreciating the risk of overheating then leads you to retrofit, which in this context is, well, potentially could just be, oh, we realize we need to install shading. Mm-hmm. Or the real estate investor knows for the next project, lads, we need to make sure we've considered shading in the building design up front rather than retrofitting it. Because do you remember how much that cost us last time? You're fostering this sense of experience and learning, which I haven't seen anywhere else. And it is done with a sector which is there to spend the money they've acquired. Like, they're there to make money, but they have to spend it. That is part of their MO. And it's really striking. This is doing all the things that social housing providers say they want to do, and the asset managers and the people that work within social housing are desperately trying to do, but because you focused on private sector, like, boom, they'll allow you. They're making it rain and you're making it work.
Do you know, it's really interesting, and I'll tell you why we are not going after the social housing market. Okay. There are a couple of reasons. One is, it takes long to make decisions, you know, and, you know, for us as a business, we would have run out of cash if we had gone after the social housing market. It's as simple as that. Now, I'm speaking as somebody who has, for most of his career, sold to the public sector. So I know how to sell to the public sector. I know how it works. I understand frameworks. I understand tenders and procurement and all those kinds of things. That's not the issue. The issue is time. You know, time that it takes, you know, to actually get decisions made. The second point is one of, you know, speed to deploy. Okay. If you're deploying in a social housing type setting, I suspect that quite often you have two or three visits to a particular building, you know, before you have actually got a chance to get in and to deploy. Okay. That's fundamentally different from what we do. We regularly install 1,000 units a week. And the only way that you can do that is, you know, if you get access, you know, quick access and ready access, you know, to the premises where you want to install the equipment.
And when you talk about, I'm just thinking about another route into social housing. What about a situation where a private developer builds like an apartment building and sells it to a housing association or a local authority, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a possibility. You know, we're not averse, you know, to working in social housing, but we haven't targeted that particular market segment for the reasons that I've mentioned.
Can you foresee issues in that case if you if your systems are built into a new apartment building, for instance, and it's sold to a council? Are they going to view it as an asset or a risk for them having this data on their tenants, for instance? What's their attitude likely to be, you know, from your experience? I know I'm asking you to speculate wildly here.
Yeah. So let's put it this way. Out of all the buildings where we've installed our solution as such, there are a very small minority where people ask, you know, or what's this and what's this all about and so on, you know. And what we do is we work with the owners and the operators of the buildings. We have a website that explains, you know, to residents if they want to have a look at it, you know, what it is that we're doing, why we're doing it, what kind of data is actually gathered, you know, and so on. And it becomes typically very clear to people that they say, that's fine, no problem, okay. And we have had some more pointed questions being asked of us or of the operator of a building. Quite often, that could have been prevented if things had been communicated more upfront. Like I said, we provide that information to our customers, and so far, even in those situations, and there was one building in particular where I think one of the students that actually sent in, you know, a note to the operator who then forwarded it on to us. I think it was drafted by a lawyer and say, oh, you know, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You know, what gives you the right to do this? And all those kinds of things. And we responded to them. And, you know, as you need to in that situation, you can't ignore it. As such, we responded to that. And the outcome was that they were happy, you know, to have the solution installed. And so from that point of view, is it possible that people tamper with those things, take them out, disable them? Absolutely. That's the case with any type of solution or technology that you deploy. The overwhelming majority, and when I say overwhelming, it's beyond 99.9%, you know, of people where we install and where we have the opportunity to explain what it is that we're doing, you know, they're quite happy with it. So I would expect the same kind of thing also to happen in social housing, especially if there's an understanding and a recognition that having a sensor that, you know, can predict, for example, dampness and mold risk, or so, I mean, that's the typical one, or, you know, indicate fuel poverty and so on, you know, that those kinds of things will actually help the resident. How would it help a housing association or a social landlord? If you have, you know, through the motion sensor, for example, if you see no movement, you know, so unexpected inactivity, if you like, where you expect somebody to be in, that's potentially a problem. If somebody's
for sheltered housing, for instance. Oh yeah, I'm thinking of somebody keeling over. You know, you could potentially help save lives.
So, I mean, you could send up or set up an alert on no motion or something like that. You know, it's possible. We don't see our solution as a life safety type system at all. But we had one situation where in a student's apartment, a student disappeared literally without a trace. The police got involved and so on. And then they took the data from our sensor, the motion data, and with that could pinpoint when the student was actually last in. And with that, they then pinpointed CCTV, managed to follow that person. And it was clear that the person actually left in a taxi with suitcases and so on and just didn't tell anybody. And that helped actually, you know, see where what had happened. So in a welfare type situation, you know, there was some resolution that came out of this, you know. And
so you're waiting for Scotland Yard to start involving you in active investigations. Yeah.
I mean, this was an edge case, really, you know, where there was, you know, a concern for a student, you know, and basically the data that we gathered helped.
It could be amazing. It could be really beneficial. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if that gives you an answer, but I think, you know, what we do work in social housing, I think the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, I've seen, and I think, and this is just a crazy thing, I've seen in social housing the new CO2 sensors that are deployed in apartments. Mm-hmm. And I asked, where does that data go? It doesn't go anywhere. It literally does not go anywhere. It sits in a display on a wall somewhere, and people don't know what it is, whether something is good or bad or indifferent. You know, it's just because the legislation has said, oh, you shall have one of these devices in your apartment. So we said, right, okay, we'll stick one in. There you go. It's there. It's on the wall. You know, it shows a magic number that changes from time to time. Nobody has any clue who's the resident in there, has any clue what it means, point number one. And point number two, there is no memory, no history, no transmission of that data, you know, so that the operator of that, who would have a vested interest in actually understanding exactly these kinds of things, coming back to the ventilation, you know, if you build a passive house, you know, and your ventilation doesn't work, you build up CO2 concentrations, you know, that are not good, not good for the resident, you know. But if you don't have that data, you'll never know.
Yeah. So this, Jeff, is why I suggested it in terms of passive house the other day when we were talking about it. I talk about you all the time, mainly because of that. Through your billions of data points, you've managed to tie operational maintenance and optimization to the increase of an asset's value. I can't wait for you to publish something about that, because I think that's a thing.
We're close to publishing it.
The thing that really excites me about what you are doing, and this isn't the only thing that excites me in this regard, there are a few things that are happening that are really interesting, is that first, you're catalyzing the understanding amongst decision makers. So the money men. Yeah. You're demonstrating the value to them of addressing a thing like climate change and demand reduction in terms of energy within the built environment. What the picture you are building can be used by other people. You're building up a degree of expertise and expectation within a broader industry, which has the potential to dovetail naturally with the nascent retrofit industry, which, to describe as an industry, is a bit of a misnomer, because it's like an incoherent group of people trying to achieve similar ends. But there isn't actually an industry, because nothing is supported yet. No one's found a way to make it work economically. But what you're doing sows the right sort of seeds that can propagate in this fertile ground. And hopefully we can turn it into something much more meaningful. Because are you using this solely in residential buildings, or are you using it in other commercial environments?
We're not really using it in commercial environments. Could we? Yeah, we could. You know, but it's a question of focus for us.
Yeah, yeah.
We're still a relatively small business, you know, and for us, it's all about focus and pace and scaling. That's what it is, you know. And really, what we're doing is, we're operating in a market segment where we have nurtured the relationships and demonstrated real value. And we're now at a point where, you know, we're scaling at a crazy rate in terms of, you know, new adoption, you know, of our solution. And, you know, that is what we're focusing on. Distractions that take us outside of that, you know, we try to avoid, just because we are an economic enterprise rather than a social enterprise in that respect. You know, we need to scale. Now, what we haven't done yet, really, is, other than some of those special projects, you know, that I've talked about, we haven't really done any work with, like, an external organization, you know, to perhaps take our data set and analyze the life out of it as such. There's a possibility.
Is there something you're actively considering? When you say there's a possibility, is that something you're actively looking at? Because there will be academics who would be wetting themselves with excitement at what you're capable of giving them. You know,
so we would be willing to consider something like that. In fact, we had a master's student who was doing a big data project, you know, work with us, who's now working full-time with us in software development. But while he was doing his master's project, I worked closely with the university on a big data project that used our data set. And quite interesting, because the academic supervisor, he said, "Oh, well, we need this data. Do you have that?" "Yeah." "We need this data too. Do you have that too?" "Yeah, we do." You know, and he was absolutely blown away, because he said he has never had in his career up until that point had a data science project where all the data was available.
Man, that, without wanting to sound like I'm blowing too much smoke up your ass, like one of the reasons why we're really enthused about this is, like, we were introduced to you by Duncan Smith, erstwhile host. And when we saw what you were doing, because, like, a fundamental aspect of how we approach our work at the consultancy and our agency is, like, we're UX strategy people. Yeah. So we thought, this dude's got a platform. He's doing sensors. Like, man, we can well add value to this. And then we spoke with you. Like, "Oh, no, mate, you don't need us at all. You've got it all covered." Like, it is staggering to see an organization that's trying to do something new, that has thought about the challenge and the needs, like, in terms of user experience.
Yeah.
One thing the way I'm currently framing it is, user experience strategy is about defining an organizational goal and aligning that with the needs of all the stakeholders in the value chain.
Yeah.
So that's the people who work within your business, the people who need interoperable technologies that can dovetail with what your business does. This means all your client-side contacts, from the procurement people to the maintenance people to the decision makers and the people who deal with the residents. Yeah. And it has to align with the needs of the residents. There has to be something within all of it for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's staggering to meet someone who... speak with an organization that seems to be delivering on all of those fronts. And, you know, like, it's still a new business. So some of it will improve over time. But, we're well impressed.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. You know, we are, you know, working on more stuff and on new stuff. Like I said, the control element, for example, you know, we've started that process and we're in the middle of it at the moment. You know, and there'll be other things coming out of it. But, you know, I think we've managed to establish our position in the ecosystem, you know, of the various building blocks that are there. So we're not a GRESB. That's not our intention. But we know that we can feed data into GRESB, you know, either directly or through intermediaries. You know, and so on. So there are lots of areas where we realize that, we still have ways to go in terms of development. But at the same time, we're probably an unusual technology business in that the people who started the business have not really come from, like, a construction or property background. We've come from an IT and telecoms and technology background. And with that, we are approaching, you know, the challenges with a fresh set of eyes, if you like, you know, looking from the outside in, saying, why is this like that, you know? And, it's because it's always been done that way, you know? Yeah. And, you know, we're looking at it and we're changing things around quite a bit. And I realize we're a disruptor in this space that we're in, absolutely. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are firmly dominant in the space that we're in. And I'll say it as a German talking about world domination is not a good thing. But, in this and what we do, we are focusing on our market segments. We're focusing on the geographies, you know, and we aim, you know, to become a household name or be a household name in that segment. And, you know, that's what we're working on.
Well, I think world domination, when it has, you know, an objective, in my view, is an objective good associated with it, and, you know, is not really quite so problematic.
This isn't the first time that Jeff's advocated for the benevolent dictator.
Yeah. Just to get back into the anarchy stuff, the detail again, on air quality, what pollutants are you, I know you look at humidity, but what other pollutants do you typically measure and what can you measure?
So the sensor that is in our multi-sensor, as in the electronic component, measures VOCs, okay? And it measures...
PVOCs, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it is not a scientific CO2 sensor, okay?
Yeah.
It measures temperature and humidity, as you would expect. It actually measures air pressure too. We haven't really used that as yet. You know, there may be relevance for that at some point. But, you know, so that particular sensor measures TVOC and, you know, that gives an indication of air quality. And what we do, the way that we report it, is we report it as ECO2. And the reason we're doing that is because... Because people have at least an idea of... you know, CO2 levels, you know, and CO2 level scales.
It's quite common for sensors to use. I think a lot of CO2 sensors don't actually measure CO2. They use TVOC as a proxy, I think. Yeah.
And the whole thing is that if somebody wants to get PM2.5 and PM10 and NO or NO2 or whatever, that's the fitwell specific sensor that we then deploy, which is significantly more expensive and that you wouldn't deploy, you know, in that quantity. But there's an academic study that was done on multimodal sensors, like the one that we've created, and the benefit of that in actually looking at, you know, air quality or well-being effectively, you know, within a particular space. And the approach that we've taken, which is that you have an affordable sensor that you deploy lots of and get longitudinal data from, as opposed to the fitwell, you know, more scientific measure, you know, which is you need an expensive sensor that you can only deploy a few of, or you can get somebody in once a year or something like that to take the snapshot. Our view is that both of them are relevant as such, but in different ways, you know, and you will never be able to do the fitwell type sensor approach in every living room, you know.
No, I know. Yeah. And that's We need cost-effective PM2.5. I'm glad you flagged it as a particularly important pollutant, and I think we need more low-cost sort of sensors, even if they're not, you know, the accuracy of the sensor is secondary to having a ballpark figure for the likes of PM2.5 is something that would be really, really, really beneficial. Do you ever include external air quality measurements as well, or do you just rely on local weather stations?
We can do it. In fact, we did what I would call an extracurricular program. This was one of the things that we did, which was, you know, in the earlier days as such, and where we just looked at a variety of different things, and we actually installed internal and external air quality sensors of the more scientific type in train stations, where diesel trains would be stopping off and passing through and so on.
Okay.
And in that case, we actually had quite a variety of different measurements, like NO2, for example, as well as the PM2.5, PM10, to see effectively, you know, what the air quality would be like effectively as trains are passing through, or when there are lots of people on the platform and those kinds of things. And like I said, we did that both externally and internally at that time.
What I'm getting at is not that this necessarily needs to, it would be ideal to have some of these kinds of this kind of data across, you know, in general for any kind of residential building, but getting to a position where you have enough data to show people the indoor air quality consequences of certain design decisions, you know, in terms of specific pollutants of concern, based on location, for instance, based, you know, if you're next to a busy road, if you've got stoves in your place, or if you've got neighbors who are burning shite, you know, whatever, that kind of information is really important, you know. Fascinating though. I could talk to you all day, and there's so much to learn from what you're doing, and I think it's exciting to see data being used in this kind of an intelligent way, you know?
Yeah, right. I'm just going to interject. We're going to wrap up now. So if you've got anything you want to communicate, get across, like, the floor is yours, Falk.
Yeah, okay. Firstly, thank you for a very engaging and interesting conversation. I really appreciate that. One thing is, and I mentioned it earlier, we have not really engaged, you know, at a scientific level, perhaps with external organizations. I don't want the floodgates to open, but if there is somebody, you know, who hears this, who this may resonate with, you know, we would consider, you know, for example, deploying, you know, something on a smaller scale or so, you know, in a particular test scheme or area or so. That's a possibility. Or potentially, you know, see if one of our clients might be willing to work with, you know, somebody, you know, to science the life out of it, effectively, out of the data that is there, you know, and see what else might be, you know, might be gleaned from it. Because at the moment, you know, again, you know, given what we're doing and what we have been doing, you know, that's an area that we haven't focused that much on as yet. We realize we're sitting on a huge pile of data, and it's just a question of, you know, what we do with it. So in a way, like I said, it's not necessarily, you know, to have the floodgates open, but if there's somebody out there who says, you know, this is really right up our street, and, you know, that would work with us. You know,
well, I can say with a degree of certainty that Jeff has some people in mind, and we'll.
I'm already thinking
it.
About people for yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Such an endeavor would sit very neatly in the pages of Passive House Plus, because there's an awful lot of plus out there. So perhaps we'll pick up this conversation elsewhere.
Yeah.
Oh man!
Yeah, one thing I wanted to just clarify as well before we let you go, Volker. This will only take a second. It's important to emphasize that your kit is as valid for new build as for retrofit projects, because I don't want people to think that it's, you know, the fear I have is that some people might think if they're doing new build, if it's, you know, to Part L, or if it's to, you know, in Ireland, our version of Part L, the nearly zero energy building standard, or if it's even to Passive House, they might just think, that's it, done deal. We've done everything. We don't need to do this kind of, you know, to have a system like this to be looking at the actual performance. But that's not the case, is it?
No, not really. In fact, okay, at the moment, we're probably retrofitting, you know, like 80% of what we deploy, but we're increasingly getting specified in, you know, during construction or before construction starts. And that just makes it easier. You know, it avoids some of the discontinuities where you have a system that's put in. You know, again, let's talk about meters. You know, if you put a metering system in that is just not fit for purpose to actually get the data out, if you can avoid that by installing it properly at the beginning, happy days. And the other thing is, like, for our multi-sensors, if you can power them on USB-C, which they can be powered by, you don't need to worry about batteries and battery changes and stuff like that, you know. And if at the design stage of a building you allow for, you know, a PoE, not a PoE, a USB-C connector, just for power, not for data, you know, to be included in the design, then it's a very cost-effective way that avoids, again, the pollution and the operational overhead of having to change batteries.
Just don't tell the occupants that they've got a USB connection to plug into, right?
I can see somebody reaching up to the ceiling to charge their mobile phone. So maybe not.
So, oh, yeah. Man. Right. Good. Thank you so much for your time. That's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed it. And we'll keep the conversation up, because I definitely want to keep an eye on what's happening with this and the influence it's going to have. Because it will. All right. Have you got anything to plug as well, apart from shout out to all the academics interested in a thing like this? Do you want to direct anyone to Utopi's website, Utopi?
UK. Yeah, it's very simple. That's probably the easiest thing. We're quite active on LinkedIn, and you'll see us there as well. And in fact, LinkedIn is probably the main social media platform that we use to actually communicate, you know, to, you know, potential customers and users of our platform as well.
So, excellent.
Yeah, thank you.
No, pleasure. All right. I'll keep it extra brief because my voice is ruined. Join Akan, join the ACB, join the IGBC. Women, check her own space. All the links are in the show notes, as will the Utopia one. Please
share this far and wide. Please give us 5-star reviews where you can or can be asked.
Even if you don't believe it, it would be ideal for us because they only care about 5-star reviews. But if you can't
even
be asked,
if you hate us,
yeah, especially, etc. If you want to talk about any of this stuff with us, we've got a bunch of people contacting us through the LinkedIn page. You're welcome to do that. Or there's an email address you can use in the show notes as well. And Passive House Plus, subscribe, advertise. It's not just about Passive House. The plus means an awful lot. So yeah, check it. All right. Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us. All right. Cheers.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.